Welcome to Thinking Out Loud, the podcast that puts you inside conversations with the most deeply passionate, intensely dedicated, and yes, the most thoughtful people in our industry. So sit back and stay tuned. They may just change the way you think.
Hello, I'm Vicki Lins, President and CEO of CTAM, a marketing organization focused on media, entertainment, and technology. Today I'm talking with Dan Feinberg, Chief TV Critic for The Hollywood Reporter and President of the Television Critics Association.
Outgoing President of the Television Critics Association.
Don't sound so happy about that. So for context for our listeners, we're here at the TCA tour, and on August 3rd, you'll be handing off the baton to the next president, and so you're looking forward to wrapping your two-year tenure in this role. By the time they hear this, you will no longer be holding that position.
Passing on the scepter,
but
yes.
But you're still in it now.
Right now, current president of the TCA.
So, Dan, for folks who don't come from this part of the industry, tell us, what is the TCA and what role do you play in the industry?
Well, the TCA is an assemblage of 230 or 240, give or take, waxes and wanes a bit, journalists who write about television, and we encompass a number of different variations on the same job. Among us, there are people who are strictly critics, reviewers, commentators, analysts. I would say I'm in that category. Then there are a lot of people who are industry reporters. There are a lot of people who do primarily actor interviews and celebrity type content. Basically, lots of different ways of covering the television industry, and the TCA has room for many of those ways.
And so what's so important about the TCA? Why would somebody want to be a member?
Well, someone would want to be a member because who would not want to be a member of the largest group of television critics in the country? And why would anyone want to talk to us? Because there's really nowhere you can find a room of 200 to 250 television critics and reporters to sell your wares to and to make your arguments to and to explain where you fit into the infrastructure and the business and the industry and this whole thing.
So twice a year, the TCA holds tours, the summer tour and the winter tour. We're here right now at the summer tour, which happens at the Beverly Hilton every year. CTAM manages the cable and streaming portions of that tour, and so we've worked together for a while on that. And we're just on day five of a five-day block that happens. So I guess bear with us, listeners. We're a little tapped out and a little overwhelmed. But I'm going to ask you, what stood out of these 5 days? What's top of mind with you coming out of it?
I think just what stands out is the same thing that's been standing out for a while, is that quality television and generally large quantities of television aren't just coming anymore from three or four or five different places. They're coming from streaming. They're coming from basic cable, premium cable. They're coming from across the pond. They're coming from, we had a show today that was, that came from India and that's going to be on Amazon. It's coming from everywhere. It doesn't fit in any single shape or size. Hour-long dramas, half-hour comedies, half-hour dramedies, long-term and long-form nonfiction programming. There are no rules anymore. It's coming from all directions, which makes my job very exhausting, but it's still gratifying to see in a five-day block like this just how much there is and how I'm not going to run out of things to write about anytime soon.
In addition to having content presented, there are also executive sessions, and you touched on the importance of folks coming here and discussing their brands, their business strategy, their view of the landscape, their plans for what's next, and sort of laying out the business analysis to the room as well. Talk a little bit about that, and what did you hear this week that you thought was particularly interesting?
Well, the executive access is absolutely central. As I said, we do a lot of different jobs and wear a lot of different hats, but one of the primary hats that most people in that room wear is the hat where they have to cover what's happening in the industry. And that's not just what the show is. It's covering what the network is, how the network sees itself, where the network has been for the last 6 months, what worked, what didn't work, where they see themselves going forward. And so we're constantly in a position where a network that was doing one thing two TCAs ago or three, is now trying to do something completely different, where their brand identity has shifted dramatically, where something like Starz, which has gone through several different permutations in recent years, comes out and they're like, we're going now for a premium female audience. Well, okay, that wasn't necessarily what you were going for last time, but tell us what that means to you. HBO, with a new corporate infrastructure that it's part of, and that more than anything, honestly, has been the sort of the story of the past couple tours, is these big, gigantic corporate mergers and what that means for different people who have been at the top of their pyramids for years and suddenly now find themselves maybe behind one or two people who came in from a corporate overlord or something. So what does it mean for their job? What does it mean for their network's business? Honestly, it's a way of getting a pulse of the industry and just, you know, going out there and seeing a show panel with a pretty star. That's great, but it doesn't necessarily give you the whole picture in the way that having someone with a president of .. title does.
What, in your opinion, is most effective in that room? What really resonates with you?
Candor, preparation. Those are the two easiest things, is knowing what your brand message is. In the same way that these people would never get in front of advertisers at an upfront without having a sense of what their message was, they should never come in front of a room of reporters without knowing what their brand and their message. They should be able to say, okay, here are people with a fresh set of eyes who see absolutely everything, who are coming from the outside. They know exactly what everyone else is doing. They know what the shape of the industry is beyond our bubble. Okay, here's what they're seeing. Here's how that's different from what we're seeing. Because, you know, they're myopic to some degree, in the same way that any of us are. We can see our world, and part of this is making the conversation broader than that.
You mentioned all the changes in the industry, obviously massive disruption, massive transformation, all happening really quickly, and in many cases simultaneously. It's been a really wild ride for a couple of years now. No real sight towards it slowing down. What is the impact it has on your job?
Well, I would say it's exactly the opposite of slowing down, and I don't even know that we're in the middle of it. I think we're really at the bottom of a gigantic wave. What this tour looked like this time, I don't think what the tour is going to look like in 2 years, if God willing we're still doing this, it's not going to look anything like this, because we're seeing all of these networks suddenly prioritizing streaming in a way that they have tentatively done for years, but suddenly now they've realized that's where we are, that's where we're going. And so this tour, we didn't have Disney Plus, we didn't have Warner, HBO Max, we didn't have whatever NBC Universal is going to call their thing. Those are the future. That's where this is going. And so the fact that we know that those things are all coming, and we know that those things are all associated with these billion dollar brands, there's going to be no denying those. So all we can do is look and go, okay, that's coming, and that means more programming, and that means more executive sessions, and it also means just more time. And for consumers, it means more money, which makes us more important, because it means that our job steering them in the direction of what's good or useful or relevant becomes more and more important, I think.
So what is the role of a critic today?
I think it's the same as it was when we talked 6 months ago, which is not the same as it was probably 3 years ago. I think that it is still it has become a curatorial relationship, because it is no longer possible for every critic to get to absolutely everything. I have a co-chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, Tim Goodman, and between us, we carve up this giant turkey, cow, whatever animal metaphor you want. But even then, we also have at least one freelance critic who we give regular, semi-regular reviews to. And even then, we're letting things slip through the cracks. There are shows that we don't get to. And if we're not getting to those things at a publication where our entire job is, as an industry trade, to cover as much of the breadth and depth as humanly possible, that means that other publications aren't even getting anywhere near that. You know, a lot of websites are only getting to the things that they know that their readers want. and a lot of newspapers and magazines are only getting to the biggest things that they think the quote-unquote subscribers want. So our job is to cover the industry. Our job is to touch on as much as humanly possible, and we don't get to all of it. So all we're doing is trying our hardest to dig through the pile and say, okay, here we are trying to make your job just a little bit easier. And by your job, I mean people trying to relax at home. It's my job, but it's how people can actually have fun and be entertained.
Well, it's also another reason why participating in the TCA tours is so important, because it does bubble it up to your attention. Now, whether or not you embrace it is a different story, but at least it puts a lot of content front and center in front of a room full of key influencers that may never make it onto your radar screens otherwise.
Oh, it absolutely does. There are plenty of people in that room who are writing daily 3, 4, 5, 6 blog posts a day, coverage on panels, and who are covering every little bit of the news. And I have colleagues who do that, and bless them. It's not my job. My job happens mostly to be reviewing things and doing commentary. And the number of things that I get around to eventually reviewing, exclusively because I saw a TCA panel and a showrunner seemed smart, or an actress seemed really invested in a role, or a clip reel was frankly really well edited, you know, there it was in front of me. I thought, okay, that looks good. It's a lot. There, you know, on a weekly basis, I'm reviewing something which under other circumstances I wouldn't have. But thanks to the press tour, I said, okay, I got to pay attention to that.
How much does personal preference come into play in your perspective on any given show? How hard do you work to look at it from a more neutral perspective versus your own just personal taste filter?
Oh, I don't think you can do that. What I do is subjective. There's no getting around that. I come at everything from my point of view, which, if I'm being honest and aware, as a white male in his lower 40s, is not really an underrepresented point of view. And so I come at things from my point of view, but I'm always being constantly aware of the limitations of that point of view. And so I'm always trying to some degree, interrogate that point of view and what it reflects about me and what it reflects about where the industry is going. And so, yes, I look at things from, and again, it's all about bubbles, but I look at things from my bubble, but I try to see things outside of my bubble as well, because I'm only one perspective, and I'm one perspective that's been probably overrepresented in this industry, both in terms of the content provided, but also the people covering it for years.
Now, you have to review things that are outside of your demo, that you, given that this, if this wasn't your job, you would never watch. How does that work? How do you sit down and watch something that's tailored to a 20-something young woman and review it?
Well, I'd like to think that's not as impossible. It's more when you get down to something like a 11-year-old child or, you know, something like that. Is do I have the perspective to appreciate what a show aimed at a 12-year-old girl is going for? And I don't know. I like to believe that I'm capable of telling good from bad, regardless of whether it's aimed at me. You know, what is something trying to do is the way I try to approach everything, is what is its goal? Who is this made for? What is the impact it's trying to have? Is it trying to make me laugh? Okay, does it? Does it seem to? Is it trying to make me cry? Does it do it honestly? Is it trying to make me like the two main characters and hope that by the series finale they're kissing? You know, does it do that? Or am I going, oh God, why are these two horribly mismatched people making eyes at each other? Is it just because they're the two most attractive people in the room? And I think I can do that. I think I can tell the difference between a good CW show and a bad CW show, because I have in my life loved many CW shows. So I have to believe that I can tell good from bad, even if it's not aimed exactly at me.
There's so much fan-based criticism out there now, and it's so accessible to everyone. Has that changed the role of the critic? Is it additive or subtractive to what you do?
I think it is a thing within the ecosystem, and I would hate to ever see it become the only thing in the ecosystem, but I would also hate to see it cease to exist, because there are plenty of things out there for passionate fans of whatever, everything. And so that's great. But then there also have to be voices out there for people who, I don't know, aren't necessarily a fan, but could be, aren't necessarily the target demo, but could be, who maybe dropped off of a certain bandwagon, but are curious if they could jump back on. So take something like Orange is the New Black. As we are having this conversation, the final season of Orange is the New Black just came out on Netflix, and that is a show that has had swings of quality over the years. And so there are plenty of people out there who are like, well, I stopped watching in the fifth season. I stopped watching in the sixth season. Okay, well, Dan Feinberg in his review says the seventh season is great. It's the most consistent season in years. The show's coming towards its finale, and it does it well. I think that has a value, and I think it has a value that you know that perspective is coming from someone who previously was able to also have critical things to say about the fifth and sixth season. So it's, you know, I think there are reasons for both of those things to exist. And I would never want to write primarily from a fan-based perspective. On the other hand, another one of the hats I wear periodically is that on certain shows that I really like, I do regular interviews on them. I do regular interviews on Better Call Saul. I do regular interviews on Fargo, because those are shows that I like and that are produced by smart people, and I like having smart conversations with those people. So lots of different ways to do it.
What's one instance where you've reviewed something and either loved it or hated it, and the fan base has disagreed with you?
Oh, it happens constantly. It happens. The large numbers of people loved the recent Hulu season of Veronica Mars. I thought it was awful. So there's an easy, very, very recent version. I thought it was pandering and boring and frustrating and concentrated on aspects of the story that I didn't care about at all, and really sold short a bunch of aspects that I like. Now, what I can do in that circumstance is I can make it clear, well, okay, here are the things I like that weren't serviced. If you care about other things, you might be a happier person than I am, but here's what I care about. So that's all I can do, and that's fine.
You talked a little bit about streaming as a priority, and you mentioned Disney Plus and NBC Universal, HBO Max. Jennifer Salk, the head of Amazon Studios, was on stage here at the tour today. She fielded a question about Netflix and numbers, and she said, you know, Amazon, we know our numbers, we don't talk about our numbers, we're not strategically driven by our numbers. We believe our value is in providing quality, curated entertainment to Prime members worldwide, which is a different proposition than competing in the general streaming universe. I noticed from social media that many of your colleagues agreed with that, and many did not. There were very differing views about the role that Amazon Prime plays in the streaming universe. What's your view on the streaming universe, that competitive space, and how the different players in it, the big players in it, are starting to form their business model and carve out their space?
A lot of it, I think, has to do with the fact that we come at things from a perspective where we want to understand the context for something. And it happens that, say, for example, and not really an example, this week Netflix canceled Tuca and Birdie, a animated comedy that apparently viewers didn't watch. On the other hand, if you go...
But
the viewers who did watch it loved it. And if you go and look at the Metacritic and Rotten Tomatoes scores, they're impossibly high. They're 100, it's 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's way high up on Metacritic. So...
That was an interesting moment, by the way, because it was basically canceled with Lynn sitting on stage promoting a different show. The timing of that seemed to be...
No, people were just saying that because he saved a lot of shows. He had nothing to do with that show.
It was your question, wasn't it?
Well, I had asked him about One Day at a Time and about Brooklyn Nine-Nine, two shows that he celebrated. But a bunch of people were suggesting at the time that because Tuca and Birdie had just been canceled, we could have gotten him to do it because he likes trumping for...
Yeah.
But no, it's a problem because we have our sense of fighting these things and arguing these things. But part of how we do that, part of how we make our arguments on behalf of these shows is with numbers. And so if we don't have any numbers for Tuca and Birdie. And literally, we have no numbers. Not a one. There is no measurement that we have at all for that show. So we can't use any of the things that we would normally use to make a rational argument. We can't say, oh, it had 7 million viewers and they're predominantly young and female, and if you compare it to this show, it's a better value proposition, and maybe this show would be a better match on this network that has this demographic. You can't do that with what Netflix does. Well, so, okay, that's a frustration from my point of view. That's a frustration from my job. It makes it so that I can't myself give a rational argument. And that's fine. But Netflix's argument is, we don't care. We don't have advertisers. Why would we tell you what the numbers are? Why would we give you numbers to compare what we do to a commercial network or cable station where they live and die on these exact numbers that you think you understand because what you understand is an old version of this industry? Why would we give you those numbers when they have nothing to do with what we do as a business? So I understand why they don't, because they do a different thing. And then Amazon does a completely different thing from what Netflix does. And because we can only look at things, we're still looking at things somewhat in a binary way. So we still look, okay, so Amazon's not advertising, therefore they pretty much have to do the same thing Netflix does. Well, no, they don't, because Amazon has an entirely different business model, because Amazon makes billions of dollars off of toilet paper and books. So we're still thinking of things in the way that we understand them. And the streaming networks aren't giving us the information to understand things in a different way, because they don't need to. And so it's hard to have the conversation. And so we're still really in the nascent forms of this entire conversation. And, you know, maybe in 5 years or 10 years, we'll have found a comfortable medium. And I hope that at that point, there are still people doing what I do and getting paid for it, so that we can then have these conversations more intelligently. For now, all we can do is flail. And that's what we do. We flail passionately.
Well, it's interesting. It takes, to your earlier point about analyzing things in context, it takes the context away to some degree. And so then you're just analyzing things based on taste, preference, style, creativity, skill, craft,
which is the
execution.
Thing, which is the thing I do as a critic.
Which is,
but then it comes down to, if I'm trying to make a rational business-based argument, which I at this point can't do for Tuca and Birdie, I just don't have the ammunition. And so all I can do is try to continue to make it on a level of passion. And Netflix then makes things more frustrating within that respect. Like if Netflix did what Amazon does, which is simply say nothing, that would still be infuriating. What Netflix has done instead is they've started giving numbers on things that have been successful. And that then becomes a wholly different frustration, because they're like, okay, this show broke a record for most views in a week. Well, what does views in a week mean? What does views mean? Whose record did it break? Because you weren't giving numbers before, so I don't have any history. Should I just assume that every show that comes out that doesn't get this treatment isn't being watched by anybody? Because you're not telling me the shows that do okay. You're not telling me the shows that do average. You're not telling me the shows that do badly. You're giving me ratings for 3 or 4 wildly successful shows out of 500. It's a struggle.
Going back to streaming, big brands, right? We've got Netflix, Hulu, Amazon.
I forgot to mention Apple. Apple is perhaps the potential biggest player of them all, and I didn't even mention them. And Apple should be a little bit worried about the fact that I didn't mention them. No, Apple is obviously, whenever Apple wants to be in the conversation, Apple is going to be one of the biggest creatures in the room. And the fact that there are...
Because of their brand.
Yes.
Because you have not really gotten a glimpse into their content yet.
Because of their brand and because of their money. And because of their success at nearly everything.
But not TV to date.
And so, but we still assume that when Apple wants to, even if it seems counterintuitive to us from the outside, they can make something that takes over the industry. And so the assumption has to be that if Apple is putting Apple's resources into original programming, that whatever they're going to do is going to be a thing that's going to force its way into the conversation. But they haven't found a way to do that yet. And they had a very, very, very surprisingly bad launch for their overall concept in the spring. They did one of those things where they invite everyone up to Cupertino and they have executives standing in front of a black backdrop and they stream it for the world and everyone's supposed to get excited. And instead of actually showing anybody anything or giving a business plan, they had a bunch of producers and stars come out and just say, "Apple, we're going to be dynamic." And a lot of people were like, "Wait, okay, in what way? What is your programming going to look like? Why would we want it? How can we watch it? Most importantly, what is it going to cost to watch it?" It was a disaster. And then less than a month later, Disney Plus did its own thing. They went through absolutely every program. They showed clips from things. They went one thing after another that you were going to want. Then they got to the end. They gave a price point that was far lower than anybody expected it was going to be. And so Disney Plus just went, okay, you know, if Apple isn't going to take over, we're just going to walk in and do it. And that was brilliant on their part. And Apple has yet to give us whatever their next – what their volley is, you know, what their response is. So we're still waiting to see how Apple is going to undo that disaster. But these are all the conversations we're going to keep having. And anyone who would rule out Apple's ability to erase the disappointment of that first announcement is obviously a fool. There's decades of precedent that says that even if Apple doesn't get something perfect initially, they'll probably find a way to turn the ship around. But the question in this case becomes, is it different when you're the billionth person out there trying to give audiences star-studded television programming versus when you have a new phone that does something no one else's phone does? No matter what their Jennifer Aniston drama does, it's not going to do something that no one else's drama is doing. It might be a good version. It might be a version that has a big audience, but it's not going to reinvent it. So what do you do if you have that? And I don't know the answer.
So many questions just came to mind because this is also so interesting. But I'm going to stick with streaming just for a minute. Two other big shifts that have just happened in the big streaming universe. Hulu has a refined ownership structure as a result of the Disney-Fox merger. So they're in a different space with new content coming under the Hulu brand. And also Warner Media just announced HBO Max. So share some thoughts on those two fronts with us.
I think Hulu has the advantage of being able to focus. You know, they're not the only streaming thing within the Disney family. Disney Plus is going to get to be the big dog. Hulu then is going to get to be the maybe slightly specialized, maybe slightly prestige-y. You know, who knows? They're still in the process of figuring out how exactly they want to say what the Hulu brand is. But they have a certain luxury in that no one is expecting them to be the entire company. Warner Brothers Max, when they announced it, HBO Max rather, I keep getting confused on its name because it doesn't really feel like HBO Max is the right name for it, but that's just my opinion because to me, HBO is one thing. HBO Max sounds like it should be HBO, but more. But so far, what they've described the more as is a bunch of stuff that doesn't sound like HBO. So, like, great, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air repeats. It sounds like a lot of fun, and sure, ooh, Friends sounds like a lot of fun. Doesn't sound like HBO. So that's on whoever to figure out. But if you have Friends repeats, people will come, and it's going to be – basically, these are companies with endless resources. And so they have the ability to make a couple mistakes if they want to and to bounce back. And so – like, there's been a lot of talk in the past week because Netflix subscriber numbers, God forbid, went down for a period. This just happens to be the first time we've seen Netflix in a position where they've had to respond, where they've had to say, okay, maybe this didn't go exactly right, but now, meh. And they have the resources to do it, and they have an executive team that obviously got them where they are. I think they now know that they can't just be exactly what they've been. They have to now compete in a more crowded marketplace, a marketplace they helped invent. But yeah, I don't think we know what the answer is. And again, we don't have a clue what HBO Max's answers are. We don't know what any of the, you know, ridiculous amounts of Marvel programming and Star Wars programming and whatever the Disney Plus is going to have. We don't know what any of that's going to look like. I think we assume everyone's going to want that, because that presentation that Disney Plus did, it was like, you're going to, here are all of your 50 of your favorite brand names. We're doing new series with all of them. Oh, yeah, and we're also going to have 600 episodes of The Simpsons? You know? I know I want that. A lot of people are still having to prove why you're going to want whatever they have.
Going back to this concept of just peak TV, so much content, your job is more challenging, consumers are challenged with having time to watch everything they probably want to watch or think about watching. How important is that hit, that one big resonates with culture, resonates with a high number of viewers, you know, power put stars on the map in a new way. Game of Thrones for HBO was huge, and everyone's now talking about what's next, what's going to happen now that Game of Thrones has ended. And when you have that sort of mega hit.
It's obviously, it's everything. It's you know, Hulu before Handmaid's Tale versus Hulu after Handmaid's Tale.
And what's your role in helping create those hits?
It's recognizing when someone's a player in the space. And even then, it doesn't always necessarily matter. You look at something like Facebook Watch, and Facebook Watch has a very good show in Sorry for Your Loss, starring Elizabeth Olsen, that no one's heard of, and that they haven't been able to get into any awards conversations, even though Elizabeth Olsen is every bit as deserving of being in an Emmy field as the people who are there. But for whatever reason, it hasn't gotten the traction. Well, when it came out, I wrote an enthusiastic review. I said, here is something you have to pay attention to, but it doesn't always work, and it doesn't always instantly hit. Well, maybe it's going to take a little while to convince people to watch a TV show regularly on Facebook, and maybe season two of Sorry for Your Loss is going to be where it's going to hit. Maybe it will. That would be great. But like, who knows, for example, who is aware that Facebook has an original scripted series right now starring Catherine Zeta-Jones? Like, I could look around this room, and I'm willing to bet that, and you can't see this, listeners, there are a lot of people in this room. I'm getting a lot of head shaking. Catherine Zeta-Jones is a big star. She is starring in a TV show. It is on Facebook Watch, and nobody knows it exists. If the differentiator for Facebook Watch is not having a genuinely good show featuring a Marvel superhero, you know, Elizabeth Olsen, as your lead, if that's not necessarily the key, if the key isn't necessarily having an Oscar-winning movie star as your star, like Catherine Zeta-Jones, what is it going to be? And I don't have an answer to that. If I did, I'd be programming for Facebook Watch. But I can just keep looking and watching the product as it comes along. And all I can do is say, here is a thing that is worth you figuring out how to watch a show on Facebook Watch. I said that, and I've said it multiple times with Sorry for Your Loss, is here is something that is worth figuring out how to use this platform for. But I don't know. And the other thing is, that because Facebook Watch doesn't give ratings, and why would they? Just because my bubble doesn't know that these things exist, someone from Facebook Watch could be listening to this right now and going, okay, you don't know this, but 30 million people a week watch that Catherine Zeta-Jones show. It just happens not to be the 30 million people who you are in any conversation with. And you know what? It is completely possible. And that is what is fun and challenging about a fragmented landscape, is that it is completely possible that that Catherine Zeta-Jones show is a massive hit with people who don't follow TV critics on Twitter. Totally possible.
How and why things catch on is really interesting. Last year at this time, you and I sat down and did a podcast, which, by the way, had tremendous response.
But you're not going to give ratings.
And we talked about Schitt's Creek. And you said at that time you were shocked that Schitt's Creek could go down as the show that should have gotten an Emmy nod but didn't. And now we're sitting here, and this year Schitt's Creek did get an Emmy nod.
Did I say that? Was I psychic?
You were psychic. You were very prophetic about that. It's interesting. It's a pop TV show. It aired on Pop TV. It then moved over to Netflix. It seems to have caught on fire once it moved over to Netflix. Did a different audience find it? What what happened in this past year?
Because they're
going into their sixth and final season, and now it is a cultural hit, a cult following, a big
Emmy.
Yeah.
Well, I think what I would have been able to have picked up on 6 months ago at this time is that when I talked to people, and not just people in that ballroom, that TCA ballroom, but when I actually went to dinner with friends or visited with my parents and had dinner with their friends who don't have anything at all to do with the industry, I saw the frequency with which that was the show that people brought up as a show that they really loved. And I saw the passion for that. And so it wasn't something like this hypothetical Facebook watch Catherine Zeta-Jones show where really I have no clue if a single human being has ever watched it. I knew people watched Schitt's Creek, and I knew that a few critics were championing it, but maybe not a lot. And I knew that people were watching it. Well, when the last season came out, it got a lot more reviews. It got a lot more articles. You need to watch this. Here's a big show, whatever. Then it got multiple TCA Award nominations, which it had never gotten before. So that Schitt's Creek was a show where I really could see it coming, where I really could go, okay, I can see where it's where the groundswell is coming from. And I think that's one where Netflix was obviously integral. And it's kind of the beauty of the Netflix algorithm is you see a show called Schitt's Creek with a couple people you recognize because you know Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara. All you're doing is clicking on it. Like, what are you going to lose? It's a silly looking show, whatever. And then suddenly you discover you like it. Well, that's great. I don't know that anyone was ever going to do that, though, if it just stayed on Pop. I just don't think that was the way things were going to work. But on Netflix, it found a huge audience, and that benefited the Pop audience. I don't know that it has, on Pop, become a phenomenon, but definitely through Netflix it has, which then allows Pop to have this phenomenon. And Pop has added several other fairly decent new comedies. Florida Girls, which premiered a couple weeks ago, is a really solid show. And I think if people find it, they really might like it. Then they acquired One Day at a Time, which has an audience from Netflix. So it's sort of going the other way. So that's how they're building a brand. And Netflix is playing this huge role in Pop building its brand. At a certain point, Netflix has to wonder how that necessarily benefits Netflix and the other streaming services within the CBS TV family. They have CBS All Access. In a perfect world, corporately speaking, for that company and that world, Schitt's Creek would have found its audience on CBS All Access. That's where it would have somehow found its audience. And then that way you have a streaming service owned by the same company as the thing that owns it. So suddenly it's all internal. Well, this is somehow benefiting two companies that aren't connected, but
it works.
I'm going to go back to the point where you were prophetic about it. So let's leave listeners with you being prophetic again. What's next? What should we be looking at? What do you think people haven't discovered yet that they should?
God, I'm cursed by having apparently gotten it right last time. That's not because there's no point, for example, in saying that what's big and next is Amazon's Lord of the Rings or something. That's not, that's a behemoth. That's a gigantic property. There's no point really. You're not going to be cool in saying, oh, Disney Plus is coming and they have a Star Wars show. I think that's going to be big. I think people are going to talk about The Mandalorian. I don't get any points for that. So I don't know. The problem is that even Game of Thrones, which was a popular book series, the difference between the popularity it had when it started and the popularity it had when it ended is so big that it's clearly not just the same as, okay, take a beloved book series and put it on TV. It's something more than that. And the phenomenons or the phenomena are the ones that you don't see coming. And so anyone trying to predict the next Game of Thrones isn't really going to have the next Game of Thrones. It doesn't work that way. So HBO might think His Dark Materials is the next Game of Thrones. Well, His Dark Materials could be successful. There's no question about that. But it's the sense of discovery that goes beyond just a core passionate fan base that allows things to kind of expand outward. And there will be a next Game of Thrones. It won't be as simple as the next fantasy book featuring a little nudity and CG dragons. anyone who thinks that they can chase it in that way isn't chasing it the right way.
Okay, well, instead of tapping into your talent just through this podcast, we'll also tell people to read you in The Hollywood Reporter. And Twitter is at The Fine Print, which is F-I-E-N. So follow Dan on Twitter, and you'll hear even more than what he's able to cover in his Hollywood Reporter work. And thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, and thank you, CTAM, for all that you do in making this press tour thing the locomotive it is.
Hope you found this Thinking Out Loud conversation interesting and perhaps even thought-provoking. There are more on the way. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave a review.